It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickert will be back in next Monday. Coming up, a large group of everyday people can outperform experts on predicting complicated international issues. We'll meet a psychologist behind some unusual research into crowdsourcing of predictions. First, this week's seen a growing list of food items being recalled after E. coli and listeria were detected in products ranging from ground beef to sprouts, walnuts, and hummus. We've asked a food scientist to help us understand what to watch out for, how we can stay safe, and what's going on, especially as we head into Memorial Day weekend. Barbara Ingham is a UW Extension food scientist and professor in the Department of Food Science. Her focus is on consumer food safety and quality. Barbara, thanks for joining us here in the studio.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, a weird mix of recalls here, not related to each other, apparently. What's being recalled and why?
You're right. There are a wide variety of products. So we have some ground beef recalled. That's probably a little more standard. We've seen recalls larger than this one, certainly over the last 10, 15, 20 years. But then there's some newer products. The hummus is a little bit different. Walnuts, there was a huge national recall related to peanuts not long ago. This happens to be a different organism with walnuts. So we're seeing some foods that we maybe haven't seen before. The sprouts, like the E. coli or like the ground beef, are a product that, at least in the food safety community, we've been concerned about for a while. Those are problematic.
We'll get into those in a bit, but I want to start with beef, a big grilling weekend, right? Obviously. 1.8 million pounds of ground beef products, according to the USDA, are being recalled. You mentioned E. coli. First, this is a big number. It sounds like a lot of pounds of beef. In the scope of beef consumption in the United States, how big a number is that?
So this isn't a very big recall, but I think it heightens consumer awareness. And really, in some ways, it's a perfect time of year because you're right. I think there'll be a lot of burgers going on the grill this weekend. With products like this, ground beef in particular, cooking is really key. Proper cooking, the endpoint temperature for ground beef hamburgers is 160 degrees.
Now, as a griller, I've heard the legend, the one flip technique. Never flip your ground beef patty more than once. Food safety people, what do you say about that?
So food safety people say use a thermometer. That's the only way you can tell. I was with colleagues this week and we were trying to figure out, you know, can you touch your hand? There's people who have all sorts of different things. But if you're with a food safety group, they're going to tell you a thermometer at 160 degrees is a safe internal temperature.
Now, before we get to the heat source, the grill, the stove top, safe meat handling instructions. We're making those patties probably with our hands. What should we be careful about?
So there are generally four basic steps for any food safety hazard that we might see. So those are clean, cook, chill, and separate. They're easy to remember and pretty easy to do. So if you're handling raw meat, washing your hands first and then cleaning up afterwards so that you don't spread contamination for a hamburger patty that you'll hopefully cook to maybe something that you won't cook, like lettuce. Keeping things cold, cleaning things, especially that plate that goes out to the grill. The plate that carried the raw hamburgers out should not be exactly the same one unless it's cleaned before it brings the cooked patties back.
I tend to think of that plate as like almost a biohazard. I like gingerly just put it right in the dishwasher and, yeah, wash my hands 8 times before I go on to anything else.
Right. You'd be amazed at the people who either serve the marinade as a sauce without heating it. There's a lot of amazing and unfortunate food handling practices that people attempt.
But you're not, we shouldn't be afraid of ground beef and avoid it solely because of a recall like this, as long as we're safe?
This is correct. And I think, you know, recalls, even if people are, they've seen illnesses, they often encompass a very large amount of product that probably isn't at all contaminated. The company brings that back to help ensure consumer safety. In this case, as with other types of pathogens that we might see in ground beef, proper cooking will absolutely ensure that the pathogen is destroyed.
No steak tartare, no raw beef.
Correct.
Okay. Let's move to the hummus. This is a new and kind of weird one, you said. Just shy of 15,000 pounds of hummus and other dips. What happens? How does that get contaminated, or do we even know yet?
Well, the organism that is the causative agent of the illnesses they've linked to this is Listeria monocytogenes. It is an organism unlike things like Salmonella and pathogenic E. coli. This one happens to be an environmental contaminant. It lives and is very happy in processing environments. It likes to live in drains and on conveyor belts and those kind of things. So we see this often linked to like dairy type products, but we would expect that a food processing environment could quite easily harbor something like Listeria monocytogenes. When hummus is prepared, it's considered ready to eat. And mm-hmm. So once it's packaged or after there's heat treatment, if the product becomes contaminated, there's not another kill step. And that's where Listeria really does its damage.
So from a consumer safety perspective, we're not all going to start microwaving our hummus to kill pathogens. What can we do?
I think paying attention to recalls mm-hmm. is really great. And I think, you know, sharing information like this does heighten consumer awareness. And that's what we need to do. Consumers tend to not pay attention to recalls. So this is a good one, especially this weekend when dips like this are probably going to be served at family gatherings.
And by the way, we've got a link to the USDA's recall information page. It's on the Central Time Facebook page. You can click over and check out the hummus you bought. Most hummus is fine.
Right. It's just these particular brands. I would imagine many grocery stores and retail outlets have notice of this, and they've posted signs. But and the use-by dates, I noticed, for these products were a while ago. So maybe it might have been almost a month ago to a couple of weeks ago. So hopefully people don't have those products around. I think one thing I'd like to add, though, is consumers, especially for ready-to-eat products like luncheon meats, dairy products, and those kind of things, if it's considered ready-to-eat, if there's a date on it, even though those dates are often quality dates, it's really important to pay attention to those, especially at these times in the summer where pathogens tend to grow really well.
Now, how about the sprouts?
For those of us in the food safety community, those are classified with raw oysters and a do not consume. You could certainly cook sprouts. They're no longer raw. They're not going to provide that crunch to your salad and sandwich. I think certainly as a baseline, you'd say those who are very young children, those who are elderly, pregnant women, and those with compromised immune systems, because they couldn't deal with the level of contamination, shouldn't consume sprouts. Really, anybody should probably take a second thought, but it's generally not harmful.
Why are sprouts susceptible to problems?
Sprouts, they spend their life at the beach, so they're grown and in very warm, moist environments, and the pathogens just take off. Those are perfect growing conditions for any kind of bacteria, including pathogens.
We also mentioned there are walnuts on there. And again, check out all those recalls. The link is on the Central Time Facebook page. Want to get into, we ate something, we're feeling bad. What do we watch for? When should we be reporting to the doctor if we're worried about Listeria or E. coli? And do we call the local public health department? How does the USDA know that there's a problem?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think for many foodborne illnesses, healthy adults, we might have a little bit of an upset stomach. You don't know if it's just you ate too much, you just don't feel very good. Maybe there's some vomiting and diarrhea, but it goes away pretty quickly. For those who are more at risk, it's certainly much more severe. Listeria tends to present, unless it's a pregnant woman, with maybe just a little bit of what we're going to call a flu-like symptom, just a bit gastrointestinal distress. Pregnant women, it's very problematic. There can be spontaneous abortion, problems with the fetus. For these others, with E. coli 0157H7, the other E. coli 0121, after a couple of days, there may be some bloody diarrhea. If you see that, it's a really great time to call the doctor's office.
Always a good time to call the doctor's office, definitely. And now you just mentioned a couple of strains of E. coli. How many strains are you juggling as a food science person? How many are out there, and how big a moving target is it?
Well, there's over 100 of pathogenic E. coli strains. The 0157H7 is the one that we've known about for about 20 years and has been extensively researched. There are about six other non-0157 toxin-producing E. coli that are also on the radar screen for public health officials and food safety officials. We're beginning to understand these. We've only had a couple of years to try to respond to either the meat industry or the Food and Drug Administration, but I know that there are those of us who are studying these. They tend to behave the same as 0157H7, but maybe harbor in slightly different food products.
All right. We'll leave it there. Thank you, Barbara, so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Barbara Ingham, a UW Extension food scientist and professor in the Department of Food Science, giving us some safety advice and some explanations behind some food recalls lately. If you've been harboring secret fantasies of being an international intelligence analyst, here's some good news. A study indicates that a crowd of average Joes and Janes can outsmart some of the best CIA analysts, even those with access to classified information. And they're looking for participants. The Good Judgment Project is a 4-year research study that was organized as part of a government-sponsored forecasting tournament. For the last 3 years, thousands of people around the world have been making predictions on issues as pressing as North Korea's next move, so whether Russian troops would invade eastern Ukraine. Results indicate that their collective wisdom can be uncannily accurate. With me to share more about the project is Philip Tetlock. He's co-principal investigator of the Good Judgment Project. He's also a professor in democracy and citizenship at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Expert Political Judgment. Philip, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you very much.
Well, you reached out to crowds to try to find answers. What's wrong with the experts? Why don't they give us good predictions?
Well, I suppose the first thing to be said about these forecasting problems is that they're really hard, mm-hmm. and that the experts do often make mistakes, and the crowd isn't infallible by any means. The crowd makes mistakes sometimes as well. But there are real advantages to drawing on a diverse group of people who make offsetting mistakes. And the average often proves to be impressive, but not infallible.
Where did this notion of reaching out to a large group of everyday people to answer complicated problems come from in the first place?
Well, the idea grew out of a National Academy of Sciences panel, which recommended that the intelligence agencies should start scientifically testing the value of the products that they buy for improving judgment. And I think you have to give credit to the government agency that launched this project because they did something you don't normally expect bureaucracies to do. Bureaucracies don't normally sponsor research that has the potential to be at least somewhat embarrassing. They're putting themselves on the line. They're demonstrating a willingness to explore alternative techniques that might improve judgment. And this is the first major effort to do that. They're basically taking up the challenge that the National Academy panel issued in 2010. And this is the tournament that goes from 2011 to 2015. And we'd welcome listeners who would like to volunteer.
So if I volunteered, what would I do? What kind of homework do I have to do?
The questions are really diverse, so I wouldn't recommend starting any homework at all until you see the questions, because they are really, really heterogeneous. I think the first thing to do is to visit www.goodjudgmentproject.com and sign up. Put your name in the queue.
But then once somebody has done that, what kind of questions are they faced with, and do they get some kind of briefing, or do you just say, go for it?
We pretty much say go for it. I mean, people work under different conditions. We run experiments, and some people work alone, and other people work in teams, and other people work in prediction markets. So the working conditions are somewhat varied. But we basically were counting on the self-reliance and resourcefulness of diverse citizens, and each individual is going to get a little bit of the truth, and when you combine all those individuals together, it often adds up to a significant part of the truth.
So you have some questions that you've asked participants, and they've individually made their answers. You've aggregated them. What kind of predictions did they come up with that did or didn't pan out?
Well, you know, you've got to be careful about how you think about evaluating probabilistic accuracy. I mean, to think about it as in poker. A famous poker player once said he could tell the difference between a world-class player and a talented amateur because the world-class player knew the difference between a 60-40 proposition and a 40-60 proposition. So often good judgment is a matter of moving your probabilities faster toward the truth than your competitors. Does that make sense?
I think so. So a question might be something like, it wouldn't be, will Russia invade eastern Ukraine? It might be something like, what is the percentage probability that Russia will move military forces into eastern Ukraine?
exactly right. So if you were an all-knowing information processor, if you knew everything there is to know, you could in principle, whenever we issue a question, you could in principle say there's a probability of 100%, and you'd always be right, those things happen. And you see there's a probability of 0%, and those things never happen. And that would be omniscience. That would be all-knowing. That would be godlike. And not surprisingly, nobody comes remotely close to that. So you're judging the degree to which people get closer to the truth rather than one side or another being decisively right.
Well, here's what gets me about how you evaluate that. Say the investigators, the people out there doing this, give their percentage chances of that event happening and say they come up with 70% likely, and the pros say 20% likely. And then it does happen. Just because it happened for real once, we don't know that it was 20% likely or 70% likely.
That's exactly right. And that's why you have to look at many judgments over time. We only get a clear sense of how good the foresight is of the crowd versus the experts when we look at large numbers of questions. When you say there's a 90% chance of something happening and it doesn't happen, that doesn't decisively mean you're wrong. There's a 10%,
right.
Sometimes the 10% chance materializes. But if you keep saying 90% over and over and over again and it still doesn't happen, the burden of proof quickly falls on you to explain why your probability judgments should be taken seriously.
So do you just continue using the same group of people as a big group, or do you try to weed out and say, hey, these people look like they're predicting consistently well. Let's see if we can pull their apparently better wisdom and see if we get super wisdom from them. Or you probably don't use the phrase super wisdom, I would imagine.
Well, we use a phrase that's somewhat close to that. We use the term super forecaster.
Oh, okay.
And at the end of year one, in 2012, we picked the top 2% out of 3,000 forecasters, 60 people, and we put them together into five teams of 12 each, and they worked together. And they just blew the top off of our performance expectations. They essentially won the tournament in year two. And then we took the top 2% of the regular people in year two, and we created another group of super forecasters.
Wow.
Each year we take off the top 2% of about 3,000, and we put them into teams. And so after this year, we're going to have at least 180 super forecasters. And we're thinking of also creating some teams of near supers because we think the 2% cutoff is pretty arbitrary. And we have some wonderful forecasters who are performing, say, in the top 10%. And we think the forecasters who are willing to put a lot of energy into this do really well when they're put together and they work together. It's somewhat analogous to what happens when you track kids in school.
Now, I'm sure you're doing a lot of statistics here, but is it possible that the super forecasters are just statistically really lucky?
That's a great question. It's always possible in any given year that the super forecasters were just lucky. Now, if it was just luck, if the reason the supers were super in year one was just luck, you would expect that in year two, their batting average would come down. It would regress toward the mean. But it didn't very much at all. In fact, they actually got a little bit better because they were energized by working together in these teams. And you see the same thing again in year three. They're really holding up their performance differential. So I'm not saying there's no luck involved. There certainly is some degree of luck, but there's a big skill component as well.
And I got to ask, are these all volunteers, or are they paid, or are just the super forecasters paid? How does that work?
They're all volunteers, and those who commit themselves to doing a certain amount of work are given an honorarium. I'm forgetting on what exactly the honorarium is, but it's not very much. But it's $100, $150 for about a year's work. So, you know, we're not talking about getting rich on this. People don't do it for the money. People do it because they're curious how good they can become. They want to improve their probability judgment. They might want to improve their probability judgment because they work in finance. They might want to improve it because they're card players, because they're poker players. They might want to improve it for a variety of reasons. They might be wanting to improve it just because they want to improve themselves. But I think the motives are pretty intrinsic. I don't think the money has much to do with it.
We're talking with Phil Tetlock about the Good Judgment Project. They recruit average people, volunteers, to make predictions about world events. They do pretty well. They compete with even CIA analysts sometimes with access, apparently, to classified information. This is Central Time. More to come on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Hi, Rob Ferret here. You're listening to Central Time. Continuing our discussion now about the Good Judgment Project. Ordinary folks volunteer. They make predictions on important world events. They answer questions like, what's the likelihood that Russia would invade Ukraine or intervene militarily? Or will we see new gas taxes in Venezuela? You name it. Turns out, competing with other judgment projects, this does pretty well, harnessing the wisdom of a crowd of people doing their own research, no classified information, and making their best guess. With me is Philip Tetlock. He's professor in democracy and citizenship at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the book Expert Political Judgment. He's co-principal investigator of the Good Judgment Project. Philip, seems like good indications about the value of the wisdom of crowds here. I wanted to talk about some things that might skew it or send it off in the wrong path. You've got volunteers. They're self-selected. Maybe if the same type of people volunteer to do this, they might manage to skew and get the wrong answers, the wrong predictions sometimes.
It's certainly true that there's the wisdom of the crowd and there's also the madness of the crowd. Mm-hmm. And it's a matter of when does the crowd contain wisdom and when does the crowd go crazy into groupthink land and conformity cascades and manias and panics. We do our best to give our team some guidance on how to behave toward each other and how to be open-minded. But there's never a guarantee that our teams aren't going to go off the rails.
Yeah, and we have both sort of referenced obliquely the book Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds, when people with a weird bit of information sometimes go off in a very bizarre direction, and all of a sudden you have a bizarre tulip craze in among the Dutch, I think it was. But so what if you've got a question, maybe kind of an obscure question? I mentioned gas taxes in Venezuela, and the publicly available information is skewed because one article got reproduced a lot or something like that, and you get a garbage in, garbage out situation. Is that something you try to control for?
That's definitely not something we can control for, because that's just part of the real world. The real world sometimes contains skewed information, and good judgment requires a capacity to distinguish useful evidence from pseudo-evidence.
So I wonder what we might start doing with this. If, as you continue this project, it holds up, these predictions are good, do you envision some sort of policy use where policymakers could use the Good Judgment Project to inform them?
Well, we very much hope that the net result of our project will be that the United States government, the president, and National Security Council and his advisors get the best possible probability estimates in from intelligence analysis. That's very much our hope, and I think that's a major reason why this research is being sponsored by the government.
Is this idea of crowdsourcing predictions branching out elsewhere? I could see maybe trying to do this with a stock market, for example.
You could extend it into the financial realm, and there's an active debate among economists about the degree to which the stock market is predictable. A lot of economists think that the stock market is a random walk and is inherently unpredictable. our evidence doesn't shed light on that particular question.
And I wanted to get a little more into what we're comparing the crowdsourcing of knowledge or of predictions to the expert. And I know you've worked a lot in the past on the problems of experts making predictions. What are some of the things that might lead very informed experts along the wrong path?
there are lots of ways of getting it wrong. One of the more common ways is to stick too rigidly to your preconceptions and fail to update your beliefs. So if you're really convinced that country X is going to have a revolution, you're going to keep predicting a revolution even though one doesn't occur, and you might stick with that position for a very long time until you finally relent.
So how can we, when we're making a decision, whether we're talking about that individual expert or with something like the Good Judgment Project, how can we get some kind of feedback loop going to correct for those kind of mistakes?
That's one of the best functions of the teams. We encourage people who are in our forecasting teams to engage in something that's called constructive confrontation, mastering the skill of disagreeing without being disagreeable. So it's bad manners not to correct somebody or to challenge somebody. So we want to inculcate those norms in the teams. We encourage people to think that way. And I think that's one of the reasons why our teams have been resistant to the madness of crowds or, you know, groupthink.
Well, you know, it seems like it might be easier if an everyday person is coming in and doing this than with an expert to train them to accept a challenge. Well, if I'm an expert, I've got years of experience in this region. How dare you question my judgment? Is that part of the problem with the individual expert?
It can be. I mean, there certainly are experts who are open-minded, but when people are ego-involved and they have a public commitment to a position, it's often harder for them to back off from it.
So what's left now in the Good Judgment Project? You've been doing this for a few years now. Is there a next step beyond what you've already done?
We've just been amazed by how good our regular citizens can be in these difficult forecasting tasks. So, and I think the intelligence community has also been surprised by the level of performance and by the degree to which it's possible to train people and help them team and work together to generate better estimates. So we're going to try to do it again. In science, replication is really important. Mm. We've replicated our basic findings three times, and we are going to be assessing replicability in a fourth year as well.
And it seems like the issues you've brought up, this would just be a goldmine for people studying psychology, group dynamics, business management. Are you getting a lot of attention from a lot of different academic departments here?
It is certainly a project that brings together people from different disciplines. We have statisticians, political scientists, psychologists, computer programmers. A lot of different talent goes into making this project work. It's a complicated project, and it depends on the goodwill and voluntary effort of our forecasters and some great academics coordinating it all.
And let's leave it. Do you want to make a pitch to people to get involved and sign on and be a volunteer?
Absolutely. If they would like to visit our website at www.goodjudgmentproject.com, we very much hope we can find a place for you in the tournament this coming year. And I think we will be able to do that.
All right, Philip, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Philip Tetlock. He's a professor in democracy and citizenship at the University of Pennsylvania, the author of the book Expert Political Judgment. He's co-principal investigator of the thing we've been talking about, this Good Judgment Project. And again, if you want to give rein to your inner analyst, check out the goodjudgmentproject.com. It's Friday afternoon. That means it's time for news guy Noah Ovshinsky to stop by and bring us up to date on what's making waves news-wise in Wisconsin this week, including a proposal to lower the number of wolf hunting permits. Noah is our assistant news director here at WPR. Welcome back, Noah.
Good afternoon, Rob. It's good to be here.
Well, let's see. What do you want to start with today? We've got a lot to talk
about. Oh, let's see here. Let's start with the latest Marquette University poll.
Yeah. These are always big. They get a lot of headlines. And, of course, they're tracking the race for governor.
Right.
What's going on this week?
They and pretty much everybody else.
Well, right.
I think media and everybody else. Right. You know, any new poll is going to make headlines at this point in the campaign season. But this one really made headlines because the poll showed that Governor Walker and his likely opponent, Mary Burke, were tied, actually, at 46%.
And that's a change from earlier Marquette polls,
any polls, yeah. Previous polls had shown, actually, Burke pretty far behind. And over time, over the course of several different polls, you know, they showed very little movement. Now, this latest poll suggests the race is actually tightening quite a bit.
nothing huge happened between the last poll and this one. I've heard Charles Franklin talking about this on the Joy Cardine show. There wasn't, it's not like there was a big bombshell. What are they chalking up this change to?
Right. So Charles Franklin, who's sort of the polling extraordinaire here in the state, he said a few things account at least partially for the change. He said Mary Burke is gaining in support among women and younger voters. According to Franklin, Burke is also attracting more male voters than she had before. And thirdly, the party affiliations of those who responded to the poll also had shifted a bit. So three factors there.
Now, that let's key in on that a little. This is an argument every time a poll comes out. It's often people who don't like the results say it oversampled the other side. Too many Republicans are included, too many Democrats included. Pollsters say sometimes people's party affiliations change. Where our sample is, as best we can, reflecting what's out there in the state. That's going to be a never-ending argument, I think, when people hear polls.
Until the end of time.
Right.
Absolutely. But, you know, three big factors here changing the game, you know, to some extent. I mean, you know, this poll obviously was welcomed by the Burke campaign. Mm-hmm. You know, previous polls, in addition to the poll showing them, you know, the Governor Walker and Burke being pretty far apart, they also showed that people really didn't know much about Mary Burke, you know, so much so that they really didn't even have a positive or negative opinion about her. And, you know, there are still a lot of people who don't know who she is, you know, but that number of people who don't know who she is, you know, is shrinking over time.
Okay. And that's, you've been talking about this for a while. That's key to the Mary Burke campaign, getting people to know who she is and making sure it's her message, not her opponent's message.
Exactly. Name recognition. You know, she doesn't have that. And so she's going to be spending a lot of her time, certainly between now and November, getting in front of as many people as possible, both in person and on the airwaves, to introduce herself to people so that Governor Walker doesn't introduce her for her.
Okay, and this, obviously, it's just one poll months ahead of the election, but probably not great news for Governor Walker. Any silver linings here for his campaign?
There is, and thusly a downside for the Walker campaign. For the Burke campaign. You know, while this poll showed that they were neck and neck, that was among registered voters, okay? Not likely voters. When you consider those likely to vote, Governor Walker still maintains a lead of, you know, around 3 percentage points or so, which is still within the margin of error. And that is among likely voters, the people who are going to go to the polls in November.
So it's been close to the margin of error in most polls, I think, though definitely Governor Walker coming out ahead. It looks like arguably at this point a close race. What's the key then if it's that close come November?
You know, I've said it before. I hate to sound like a broken record, but I am going to say it again, that this race will be all about turnout, mm-hmm. Especially in the case of Mary Burke. She needs to get as many of those young folks, people in minority communities, people who don't vote in as high numbers as others, to come out and vote for her. That's really the way that she's going to win. And of course, we'll only know in November as far as how many of those folks are going to show up for. But regardless, that's going to be key.
And it could be a lot of preaching to the choir. Dane County and Milwaukee County for the Democrats, that suburban belt, Waukesha County, Ozaukee, and the like. Republicans just trying to make sure, not persuade people, but just make sure their people get out to vote.
Exactly. And, you know, there's no big race, you know, this year. You know, there's no presidential race.
It's not a Senate race.
There's no Senate race. You know, so there's no larger race to get the base excited and even to bring independents out. You know, that helps a lot. You know, both Senate races and especially presidential races get people to the polls. And that effect is not going to be in place in November. So we'll see.
All right. We'll talk plenty about these elections between now and then. Let's move on to the UW system now. New president Ray Cross in the news this week.
Yeah. During an event on Tuesday, he said that he'd be seeking the largest increase in financial aid in system history in the next budget.
So he's requesting that from who? Regents, the state?
Yeah,
the feds?
I mean, from the region, you know, from the regents, uh-huh. and ultimately, obviously, from the state. You know, he says, you know, the recent tuition freeze, which we've talked about, has helped keep school affordable. But there needs to be a real big bump in financial aid in order to attract, you know, low income students. And that, you know, would have the effect of increasing the racial diversity of the student body throughout the UW system.
So partly diversity is part of his goal here. Anything else apart from financial aid?
Yeah. Cross also said that the system needs to do a better job, not only of making it financially viable, but actually preparing minority students for college. He says the UW is looking at creating a statewide tutoring program in order to make that happen. We don't have a lot of details on that yet, but he did introduce the idea earlier this week.
And then I heard on WPR News this morning that he's also looking at this program allowing high school kids to get college classes, but tuition free. How would that work?
Right. So this week, President Cross also talked about this idea of allowing high school students to take college classes. He compared it to a program in Minnesota that allows high school kids to take college classes tuition free. And so what President Cross has said is what he'd like to propose, rather, is covering the cost of tuition for a year for a high school student to take college courses. And again, that's in order for them to, you know, get through college quicker. More than anything else, and also to make it more affordable.
What's the timeline on whether that's going to happen, that's going to get clearance?
Right. I think his plan is to set aside some money in the next budget in order to pay, I think something like $1 million, to pay for that first year of tuition. It looks like he'll formally submit this proposal to the Board of Regents in two weeks, although the board, I don't think, is expected to take it up, actually, until later this summer.
All right. And now I mentioned earlier new numbers and new wolf quota in Wisconsin's hunt. What changed and why?
Right. So the Wolf Advisory Committee, which is a group of, you know, various stakeholders, they came out with their quota recommendation for this year's wolf hunt. And the number is significantly lower than last year. The group recommended the quota be set at 156. That's 100 or so less than 2013.
So how big a difference would that make in the state's wolf population?
Well, according to DNR scientists, a quota of 156 would shrink the population by anywhere between 5 and 20%. Of course, there's a lot of variables at play, but they think it would be somewhere between 5 and 20%.
This issue is not without controversy. Who are some of the people at the table trying to set this number?
Always controversial. This advisory committee represents a very diverse set of opinions when it comes to wolf hunting. You've got scientists, the Wisconsin Wildlife Federation, Wisconsin Bear Hunters Association, Timberwolf Alliance. The list goes on and on. You know, some members recommended a quota of zero, while others recommended a quota at the much higher end, something like 300. And so
they just about split the difference.
They basically split the difference.
And that makes everybody happy?
Yeah.
No,
Dave McFarland. No, not at all. Dave McFarland, who is the large carnivore specialist with the DNR and somebody we quote often, was quoted in the Journal Sentinel as saying basically, you know, that the quota wasn't going to make everybody happy, but that it accomplishes the goal of, you know, shrinking the population in a measured way.
So was there a sense that the number last year was too large, or maybe this is a rough winter? Do you know what was behind wanting to have a lower number?
Well, I think they're taking a look at the wolf counts that, mm-hmm. that came this year. And keep in mind, you know, this is a recommendation only. The DNR board can set whatever harvest quota they want. Now, granted, the last year the board did accept the recommendation okay. of this advisory committee, but we won't know until the DNR board votes on the quota at a meeting on June 25th.
June 25th. Okay,
yep.
That's something we'll probably talk about that week, too, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and then national news coming home to Wisconsin here. We've talked about it some this week on the show. All these gay marriage, same-sex marriage rulings happening around the state. Used to be we talk about one state at a time. Now it's, you know, coming in waves of two to five at a time. We've got news here in Wisconsin. What's the latest?
So, you know, we in the media and probably a lot of folks out there are waiting for the ruling that could come down really any day now that will determine whether Wisconsin's gay marriage ban is constitutional. And just today, Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, in anticipation of that ruling, is asking the judge in the case to stay the ruling if she strikes down the ban.
So this is to avoid a situation we've seen elsewhere, right? What happens when that ruling goes down and the stay doesn't happen right away?
Exactly. Something similar to what happened in Michigan and Utah. According to the motion, they want the stay to ensure that while an appeal is pending, and certainly the state government is looking to appeal if the ban is struck down. According to the motion, they want to ensure that there's what the state is calling chaos, confusion, uncertainty, and ultimately further litigation that could come out of a situation where it's struck down, but a stay is not issued. So, in fact, people could get married if they wanted.
And they use other states as a precedent?
Yeah, they point to Michigan and Utah as an example where there was a flood of marriages when judges in those cases decided not to issue stays, but an appeals court later stopped the marriages. And so there were, you know, dozens, if not more, marriages that were sort of in legal limbo.
In limbo, in effect.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the attorney general said earlier this week, it's my job. It's the constitution of the land at this point. I need to defend this thing in court. Any indication from what we're talking about now and the stay, if he's still planning on that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think based on the motion that he filed, this definitely indicates that the state of Wisconsin is certainly going to appeal. It's interesting in the motion, if you look at the language, the motion suggests that if the ban is struck down, this chaos, confusion, uncertainty that I was talking about just a minute ago, they indicated that that could happen because clerks in Dane, Racine, and Milwaukee counties could potentially allow same-sex marriages. And of course, in the motion, they named those three counties specifically as places where same-sex marriages would likely take place if the ban was struck down.
And this, again, is in the midst of lots of things going on around the country, Oregon and Pennsylvania just this week.
Literally just this week. Yep, mm-hmm. Exactly. The gay marriage bans in those two states were struck down. The difference between Pennsylvania and here, however, is that state is not appealing the decision. And so gay marriage is allowed in Pennsylvania as well as Oregon.
So are we counting the days? I mean, could it be any day next week, say, that a ruling could be issued?
Yeah, a hearing is officially scheduled in several weeks, but the judge in the case could make a ruling before that hearing. And so right now it's a waiting game. It's anybody's guess as to when that ruling will come down, but I guarantee there are a lot of people waiting to hear what the judge is going to say.
All right, that's it. Noah, thanks for joining us again.
No problem. It was my pleasure. Have a good holiday weekend.
Hey, you too. You too. We'll see you next week. That's Noah Ovshinsky. He's our news guy here on Central Time. Official title, Assistant News Director at WPR.